Hey, what's up, everybody? This is J.R. Hamintosh, an author of You Know It's True, my fourth and final collection, as well as You Shall Never Know Security, which is my first collection, and I have some other ones, too. Check them out. Why don't you?
Isn't this technically you have one more collection, posthumous release?
I do have one more collection, posthumous release, but I won't be there. I just hope my estate sticks with my title. I can't really control them once I'm dead, right?
That's true, and this is Derek Sotak. I wrote The Field Guide to Nachos, Nachos and You, and Recipes for the Nachronomicon, as well as the William Hope Hodgson role-playing game, Gray Caesar Dreaming of My Death, all available at Nachronomics.com. I'm bringing the same energy you did, my friend. I'm liking, today's a good day. Let's go.
And for the autumnal season, you have a very creaky chair.
It's true. Look at this. Woo!
Just, that's, you know, keep that weight in equilibrium there, my friend.
Well, good luck with that.
So, we have been not getting... I mean, some people have commented before that, hey, we used to cover a lot more short stories than we used to.
And did we? People are actually saying this, or you're just saying this?
People are saying it. People are saying it. The peoples are talking. Our enemies, okay. It sounds like the people are plotting for our downfall. But we've been thinking about getting back and discussing a couple short fiction, which is also a good way of actually making sure we're discussing something we like, other than the rolling of the dice, sometimes quite literally, that results in the movies we watch.
Well, I mean, at least it's an hour and a half commitment, as opposed to, oh, I gotta read a 1,000-page book, which is what I'm in the middle of doing.
But we don't do that. No, yes, we're reading a 1,000-page book consisting of many short stories.
Yes, yes.
And also, no one told you to read the whole fucking book.
Well, how am I gonna pick the best ones if I don't read them all?
I mean, that's Derek dedication.
I mean, we've already covered most of these via your picks for other short stories in the
past. Which I'll mention. But,
jump into it, my friends.
We are covering the book The Dark Descent. This was a giant anthology published in 1987 that at the time of its release tried to sort of sum up the state of short horror fiction. Its origins were that the editor, David Hartwell, was at a horror panel, and when it came time for the authors to all state their influences, all of the influences were short story writers. He asked the panelists why that was, and the answer was something that I already know, all the good stuff is short fiction. Which I kind of agree with. I can't remember the last fucking horror novel I read that was good at all. And a lot of what people consider classic horror novels, like Dracula, Frankenstein, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Well, those would be novellas today. Those are pretty short.
I mean, they're like 200 pages. They're not like 50 pages.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde's like 90
I mean, that's
pages.
A short story, but I wanted to say Godzilla there for a second, but Dracula and Frankenstein, those are all like 200-page books.
They're big-ass font, though.
Okay.
Anyway, so he has a theory that horror has, you know, primarily been in the short story, and it's the horror novel that is the newer avant-garde development, although keep in mind this was 1987, so.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to make an anthology to represent the evolution of the short horror form that describes and points out all the boundaries in the field. He just discusses a little bit of the history, how horror was almost all short fiction until the 1970s horror boom, created by the unusually popular novels like The Other and Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist. And then horror writers kind of basically, he says, cannot resist the temptation, which basically means they sold out and started writing kind of schlocky horror novels. Horror novels grew out of the varied novellas and short stories. He writes that horror fiction was traditionally and incorrectly just associated with manifest signs in the text, like the appearance of a ghost, when in reality it is the atmosphere that creates a horror story. So therefore, any work can be a work of horror, as long as the atmosphere allows for it. And that's why throughout this collection, there are a couple stories that you might say, oh, this is more like sci-fi, oh, this is more of like realist drama, maybe, or you could like, so it's not like, I mean, a story I've already discussed before, Bright Segment, which is one of my favorite stories, is included in this collection, and arguably it's not horror, it's more like psychological. I mean, I guess you would say it is horror, but it's, or you could just say it's like psychological realism.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of goes back to the try to break things off into different silos of, oh, this is sci-fi, this is horror, and the crossovers in between there that we've talked about before.
Yeah. The emotional transaction is paramount and definitive, and we recognize its presence even when it doesn't work as it's supposed to. Which is actually a kind of interesting point that Freud pointed out, is that like, even when you can always recognize an attempt for something to try and be scary, even if it fails terribly, you can still recognize the attempt.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure someone could think of some things that go against that, but that sounds good for now.
How could they go against it? Because then they wouldn't be recognizing that it's horror.
Good points.
He believes that there are really three principal modes of emphasis in horror: the moral allegorical, the psychological metaphor, and the fantastic. It is a spectrum, kind of like what I'm on, from the overtly moral at one extreme to the ambiguous at the other. The first types of stories, which he calls the color of evil. Which I don't exactly know why he came up with these like purple descriptions.
Yeah, because purple prose sells better.
What the fuck does the color of evil mean?
I mean, it sounds spooky.
What color is that?
Like a beige.
Why the color of evil? Why not just like the introduction of evil?
Yeah.
The color of evil? It's fucking stupid. Anyway, the color of evil. These stories are usually about the intrusion of some supernatural evil into consensus reality, like demons, hauntings, haunted places, witchcraft, and Satanism. Written by a lot of lapsed Christians who have lost their belief in good, but still believe in evil. This is the most popular mode of horror fiction. His second grouping of stories, The Medusa in the Shield, which I don't even know what the fuck that's supposed to even mean. Is that like, reflects back?
Yeah, I guess. Reflects the evil back at you, perhaps?
But if the Medusa is in the shield, and you're attacking the Medusa, it bounces back? I don't get it. Wouldn't it only reflect back if it's like another Medusa shooting it at you, and you're using the shield to block
perhaps
it?
Next week when we dive into that section, we will gain some further insight onto this.
So, those are stories of aberrant human psychology embodied by a metaphor, like Dracula, or purely psychological. This is why he says something like Joseph Conrad's The Heart of Darkness can be horror fiction, although I read it and just thought it was boring as fucking shit. Have you ever read
it? Yeah, that's one of the biggest disappointments you might have in your life if you watch Apocalypse Now and be like, oh, I'm interested in this. I'll read Heart of Darkness. That'll be cool, too.
I didn't get it.
It's not.
What the fuck is the point? What is the appeal of that book?
I do like the idea of a story of like a man kind of descending into the madness of the wilderness.
I'm already living it, but I'm in an apartment.
But I mean, I don't think it's not as cool as that statement leads it out to be.
And then the third stream, A Fabulous Formless Darkness, are stories about ambiguity as to the nature of reality, and they kind of lack an explanation that makes sense. It is the doubt that disturbs us, the surreal or the absurd. He says in the moral allegory strain, it shows what reality is and always has been, evil. Psychological stories show us repressed or unarticulated psychological states, and the third strain maintains the pretense of reality only to destroy it, leaving us with a new world entirely. And he said the mass horror audience is not so taken with these third stream stories. Because they're the type of people who write, duh, nothing happens. What the fuck? WTF. What?
Yeah.
That was it?
I mean, we are covering today a story where maybe something happens, maybe nothing happens.
Yeah. I would quibble with some of the placements. Like, Call of Cthulhu is in the first Color of Evil section, although Lovecraft would dispute that and place it more as a metaphor of cosmic fiction, you know? Although I guess the cultists do the kind of evil thing of killing people.
Yeah, I mean, there is an actual physical monster in it, I think, might be why it ends up.
I also don't understand how The Reach, Stephen King's The Reach, would fit the definition. I also don't understand what the fuck happens in that goddamn story also.
There's a zombie or something? A zombie outbreak?
But it's like they're not even evil, are they?
I did not read it when I was going through this again, because I'm like, oh, any Stephen King thing I've read before.
And also,
not gonna pick it out. No,
the monkey was put in the psychological section instead of the color of evil.
Yeah, and again, physical monster.
And then there's like Shulk and the Painter, or the Fall of the House of Usher could probably go in the evil section, or, you know, so you can fucking quibble, right?
Yeah, at least Shulkin has a monster in it.
That's what
Usher,
I'm saying.
I didn't
it's
read
not.
Again.
It's not in the first section. It's in the second section.
I mean, Usher, I didn't read again this time, having read it in the past. But there's not like a thing in that, if I remember correctly.
I think Shulkin might have been in the second section because the emphasis of that story is a lot on the guilt the guy feels about like not stopping it rather than the monster itself, but who the fuck knows. So in the past I've actually discussed The Whimper of Whipped Dogs by Harlan Ellison, the story Bright Segment by Theodore Sturgeon, and the story Evening Primrose by John Collier. So obviously when I discuss those stories, I all got them from this fucking one collection.
Yeah, I mean, I wish you told me that instead of me having to buy three different things in order to get all these stories.
Hey man, we gotta support the arts, my friend. Mm-hmm, one other last thing I noticed on the collection.
Not a lot of we here, a lot of Derek here doing this.
Also on the collection, I noticed that, like, you know, when they try and sell the book, it's like Stephen King, Clive Barker, blah, blah, blah. There's what, like, John Collier is on there? Yeah. I'm like, is he?
I did. It looks fucking, like, was he bigger back in the 80s?
Yeah, is he we'll a name anyone's supposed to know about? So we each picked a story that we liked. I'll go first in my Color of Evil section. I picked If Damon Comes. I didn't mean to emphasize come like that. How about this?
Especially with a child.
If Damon. He's an evil child. I don't. Rules don't apply to them.
Do you want to start off by saying why you picked the story, or
yeah,
the story
I will
first and then say why you picked it?
No, I'll start off why.
This might not have been one that I was entirely behind.
Does that mean you
I get it. But
does that mean you didn't like it?
I mean, it was okay.
I mean, look, I'm not saying this is the fucking greatest story. Uh-huh. And I would have picked Derek's if he hadn't picked it.
Oh.
Fucker. So it's called If Damon Comes, written in 1978 by Charles L. Grant. And then that Omen had come out in 1976, so I think by then Damon was at that point basically accepted as official evil child name.
Damon and Damien are two different names.
They're the same fucking thing. Damon, Damien,
they're different. That's how this works.
Damien is just Damon with an E in it.
Oh, okay.
It's close enough that you hear the name Damon or Damien, you know there's evil children.
Yeah, and JR's the same as BJ. Because it's just one letter different?
That's what I... That was my pickup line, and...
Oh!
All it got me was your ass there, Derek. So, do you know anything about Charles L. Grant?
I read a... He wrote an X-Files novel back in the day that was pretty good.
You know,
and then he wrote something... It was like a quartet of books about the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, maybe, coming to a small town that I am wondering now, in retrospect, if it's the same town featured in Damon Comes, but I can't remember, so I do not know.
I knew when, did you read the whole quartet of books?
I only read the first one, because this was back in the day before the internet was a thing, and I don't think they came out in, like, a regular order. I'm not even sure if they're all out yet, but, there was not the quartet when I started it.
You know, when I saw that he wrote X-Files fiction, I knew if Derek had ever read anything by this guy, it's going to be...
It would be the X-Files one. You know me too well.
It's going to be...
Did I ever tell you about my inactive website, The Intox Files, where I would get drunk and then review X-Files episodes?
Hey, that's a good idea.
It was pretty good.
Why don't you bring it back?
I realized, oh, maybe I'm having an alcohol problem. I should probably stop drinking.
How many episodes did you get in?
I think I got through season 3. So, oh, like, the good stuff.
Did you film yourself or record yourself?
Oh, no. So I just wrote notes about all this, and then I would then decipher them later on.
Damn, that's a good idea. You should bring that back.
Yeah, maybe I will, I say as I am drinking a Cobra Fang right now.
I mean, that's a classy drink, man.
It is.
So I do see his collection Tales from the Night Side, which includes this story, is on Kindle for only $4.
Oh.
I mean, not like I'm going to splurge. I don't need another fucking unread collection on my Kindle. But so he is described as the most important anthologist of horror fiction since August Derleth, which sounds like faint praise indeed. Mm-hmm. What does anthologist mean? It's like, oh, I put other people's good stories together side by side.
Yeah, they find the best stuff. I mean, it's like a chef, right?
It's
you find
the same
best
fucking
ingredients
people
and you mix
every...
them together to a delicious thing.
You ever read those stupid fucking best horror of the year? One, they don't have my stories in them, and two, it's the same fucking dumbass authors over and over again.
Those are the Ellen Datlow ones.
They're all the same shit, but yeah, the Ellen Datlow ones.
I have not recently. As a teen, I would get those and, you know, burn through them because, you know, oh, I'm a youngin. I need me them horror stories to feel alive, but I have not read any of those anytime recently.
And now you're an old man who realizes nothing could bring back that kick of excitement.
Exactly.
So he put together the original series Shadows, which was often nominated for Best Collection of the Year. He's a prolific novelist and short story writer in his own right. He had a lot of stories take place in Ox Run Station, which is his fictional Connecticut town that this story takes place in. So how to describe this story in a way that can convey why I like it? It's not like the greatest story of all time. I wouldn't even necessarily call it a classic, but it's engaging, it was brisk, It kind of packed a lot in its 10 pages. I feel like it did a lot of things right, and it felt like a kind of solid old-school ghost story of the kind I normally don't enjoy, but I don't know, this one kind of won me over. Mm-hmm. It opens with Frank walking through the creeping fog in November cold. And I kind of think every Charles L. Grant story involves November cold and creeping fog. He's looking for a cat he knows ain't coming back. He knew this half-breed Siamese was gone when he saw the saucer brimming with milk and his son Damon beside it. He's walking through this cold November, reminds him of a party last year, when he had too much to drink and he ended up on a street corner making out with a woman who was not his wife. He turned around and saw Damon staring at him. He wondered what Damon thought and what his wife Susan might have heard about, but Damon had acted like nothing had happened.
Well, nothing lasts forever, not even cold November rain.
Wouldn't you be more concerned about, like, why is your 8-year-old, 9-year-old son randomly outside at night?
Yeah, that is kind of weird, too. Like, what's this kid doing like, out at whatever
they
time
they mention
of
that,
is?
They're like, what was he doing there? But it's like, if I found out that my 9-year-old son was, like,
stalking
in another part
of
town
in the middle of the night,
skulking around, I'd be like, one, how the fuck did you get out? Two, how the fuck did you get out here? Three, why the fuck you keep doing this?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's precocious, and then there's just dangerous and creepy.
Yeah, I mean, there's cock blocking, which is what this kid's doing.
So anyway, this poor Damon had already lost two dogs to speeding cars, a canary to some disease, and he had two potential brothers who ended up stillborn. Damon was becoming a bit of a bother, and the doctor said he was too dependent on his home, his mommy, and his daddy. So after that kissing episode, Damon started showing up outside our main character's office once a day for the next 3 weeks, just looking through the window to make sure dad was still there. Although, like, doesn't he need to go to fucking school or something? Would they be like, hey, Damon, why are you always out every week?
Maybe stops by on the way home from school.
Skulking around. So our main character is talking to his son about the cat, thinking his son looks way too skinny. Mom isn't home yet, and Frank thinks that his wife is always late. She's a lounge singer, and she works so much her son has never even heard her sing. Which, I mean, how much does that date that story? A lounge singer? Is that even a job that exists anymore?
What year you said this was?
Like 1978 or something?
78, yeah. All right, so yeah, that dates it.
I mean, also the main character is wearing a leisure suit throughout it, so that's
all
of a piece.
Yeah.
Damon thought his dad was going to get lost in the fog, which sounds like a threat. His wife finally comes home, and when he tries to make a joke to her, in the old days she would have laughed, but now she frowns at him as though she were dealing with a dense, unlettered child. They both silently think about how Damon has gone out, like the night in the fog, when he shows up in the park sometimes while Frank was eating lunch, or just any random-ass place where Frank is, he shows up like a shadow or a conscience. Again, very weird. They start bickering, with Susan saying, "You don't care about him, do you?" and how he follows Frank around because he's scared of losing him. And Frank gets upset that Susan is out working late as she's not fulfilling her motherly duties. And he unthinkingly, he slaps her. And Damon is watching, staring at his father. It's also seemed a little bit out of character, like all of a sudden he just smacks her. But whatever. Over the next few days, it seems to Frank that Damon is just tolerating his mother, which seems odd since Frank struck her. And Susan seems to be resenting the fact. Damon would walk to Frank and slide his hand around his wrist or into his palm or his hip pocket, which is just kind of another warning sign. I mean, just meaning you have a fucking creepy kid. Not surprisingly, Susan now wants a divorce, and Frank thinks to himself about how he tried to be fine with her working until the dishes piled up and the dust stayed on the furniture. So, you know, this was of a past generation. Damon doesn't want to go to the city with his mom, as the city doesn't like him, and Damon asks if it was because of the lady. Damon said he told his mom, and he says his dad wasn't supposed to do that. And when Susan hears that, her smile is grotesque.
Obviously, Damon never learned snitches get stitches.
I mean, it's hard to give stitches to a dying child. So Damon moves. Frank keeps thinking he's seeing him everywhere. And it seems that Damon is losing weight and not liking the city too much. Now, it's mid-January, and he learns that Damon's in the hospital with something like pneumonia. And when he visits Damon, Damon's too thin to be real, too frail. And he thinks about how the cat went missing, and he thought Damon looked too frail then, but he said nothing. It's kind of fucked up how his wife didn't tell him that, like, oh, by the way, our kid is, like, dying in the hospital.
Yeah, that's not particularly a great move, right?
Yeah. He's like, oh, you know, if you had, if we told you and contacted you, he'd want to run away and come back to Ox Run Station, but that's not an excuse. So the next sentence, Damon is dead. And like I said, I guess this story packs in a lot, right? It's like, next sentence, oh, the kid's dead and we have the funeral.
Yeah, that is one of the things I like about this story, is that there are a lot of interesting time jumps even within sentences sometimes. Like, I cannot pull out a particular one, but it's one that's like, oh, Damon's at my office, and it happened over multiple months until this resulted in that. Like, oh, that's a lot going on for just one sentence.
Yeah, it's moving pretty briskly. You know, it's it's got its impact it wants to have, so it's keeping the show rolling. It's not like a Jenner Hermitage story where everything's like, you know, broken down and autist level bullshit. So yeah, next sentence is Damon is dead, and then there's a funeral, and he swears he sees Damon at random times. Anytime there's fog or rain or clouds or wind, there Damon would be. And he thinks, oh, it's just the guilt. Though it's hard to explain away this next part. He finds that old Siamese cat neck broken in front of his house. He realizes there was no guilt, just a little boy who loved his father so much he'd never leave him. But then we kind of start getting interstitially. I guess we see Damon's thoughts. He thinks, like, you've been a bad boy, Daddy, and that you never did like that cat or the dogs or Mommy. So Frank is talking to Susan, who says, oh, I feel so alone. And, you know, Damon just wanted to go back to Ox Run Station. But the phone gets all staticky and the lights flicker, and Frank senses Damon, and he realizes he was wrong the whole time. Damon didn't love him, not since the night he kissed that other woman, or he had not really tried to find that cat. He starts yelling over the phone that Damon will be back, and if he does, just tell him I'm sorry, while we then kind of interstitially hear Damon's thoughts, which end with, Daddy, I'm home. I mean, I thought it was just kind of a nice little, like, foggy little spook show. I mean, of course, it makes no real sense, and I like how there's no real explanation for how Damon has these powers or could come back from the dead or make phone lines staticky or lights flicker.
Yeah, like, that was my issue with it. Like, his evil turn didn't seem really warranted. Like, I know he's like, okay, here's why. I'm like, okay, none of this really paid out or was explained during the course of this.
The kid's a little creepy fucker who shows up at random times, you know he's evil.
Yeah, I guess that's how you sell it.
Well, I guess he was always evil, and he had psychic powers of some kind, and I'm not exactly sure why he killed the animals. He just didn't want any competition, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then he was mad at his father for fucking everything up and making him leave Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to come back and get his beyond the grave revenge. So I guess this kid has both the power of having psychic powers while he's alive, and then being alive, then coming back as a ghost. So
yeah, what a deal.
This kid's got pretty packed here.
Yeah.
But I thought the story was like a nice little, I don't know, it worked for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is fine overall. Again, I don't really know if I bought the evil turn. Like, if you look back at it, I can kind of see, like, okay, maybe this and maybe this, maybe this.
Well, Derek, but what else am I going to talk about? Call of Cthulhu, you ever heard about that one before?
Oh, I have heard about that one. I mean, this is the problem. Like, we've covered all the best stories in this collection already. Or they're two name brands that we are going to cover.
Well, I mean, I think you got one of the best stories next.
Well, I mean, you could have picked it.
Yeah, but I wanted to give it to my buddy.
Okay. You want to talk about Shirley Jackson, or are we just going to assume everyone knows about Shirley Jackson?
We're just going to assume everyone knows about Shirley Jackson.
Okay. Hey, did
what
you
am
know
I supposed to say? Hey, Shirley Jackson.
Two short stories that actually people care about?
What, the lottery?
Yeah. The summer, I mean, people. Like, this is one. So I'm going to talk about Summer People here. And Summer People is one I did not read until I read The Weird a couple years ago, whenever that came out. And I sure wish I'd read it earlier, because yeah, what you hear about the lottery, which is like, I mean, the lottery is good, of course, but you can also, you know, have people read her other good stories, like The Summer People, but no, people only care about the lottery.
I feel like The Summer People is like the perfect short story for what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it is very good, as we will get into.
I mean, also, there's another, the story Demon Lover is in her, and this is this collection also, from Shirley Jackson.
Oh, I never
Although
got on that
the
part pro- yet.
The problem with that story is that the fucking title is a spoiler.
Wait, is the lover a demon in it?
Yeah, I mean,
oh my
it's
goodness.
It's supposed to be ambiguous, but you're kind of like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's like the problem, right, with the title. Unless it's something like John dies at the end, where he doesn't actually die. Throws you off.
I feel like, so I think The Summer People and The Dog Park by Dennis Etchison, which we've also discussed before, like, the two perfect examples of this kind of the horror story. Though I find it interesting, you didn't really like The Dog Park that much.
So I think the dog part was too ambiguous, maybe. But I do like a story where maybe something happens, maybe nothing happens. You're not entirely sure. It's left ambiguous. And I think the dog park was a little too much into ambiguity. Like, I mean, at the end of that, where there's like, oh, there's a ravine in this dog park, and like, I don't know, fancy parties too involved.
Yeah, the weirdos are clapping.
Yeah.
I think that's a little too mountain lion.
A little too much at that point. But some people is like, oh, everything here works towards.
So you need a 60-40 in terms of action versus ambiguity.
Yeah, I'll go with that in bounds.
I'm a sophisticate who wants that 51-49.
Oh, listen to this guy. Well.
So, do you know anything else about Shirley Jackson other than she's played by Emily Moss in that fucking movie, Shirley?
Oh, I think I knew that fact, but that was the extent of it. And then I do not know anything else about her.
All right. Well, she wrote Hill House.
Yep, she did. And We Have Always Lived in the Castle.
And other books that are presumably pretty good. I mean, I've never read anything by her so far I have not liked.
So Hill House, the story was pretty good.
Yeah, like the short story. It's great. I mean, the novel.
Yeah. I've only seen the movie version of We Have Always Lived in the Castle, and I was not super impressed.
Yeah, but it's not. She didn't fucking write the movie.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, like, I with the underlying story that presumably it is based off of, I guess I don't know how closely it hews to the actual story.
I mean, it's still, even if it's note for note the same thing, they're completely different mediums.
Well, I mean, I can at least, like, say, oh, the story's kind of so-so, or not.
Okay.
Which I would say, We Always Lived in the Castle, kind of so-so. But perhaps the book is better.
I did like the description of the story in the book. It's like the main couple, the Allisons, that says, like, they've broken a rule and it will be punished. The story has the form of a moral tale, but without the morality.
Is it, though? Like, yeah, are they punished because they are city people who come in to enjoy the summerness that the locals
but that's hardly enjoy. A moral failing.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, they are something is happening to them because of that, right?
Yeah, but I guess it's saying, like, you know how the forms of the moral tales back in the old days would try and impart some kind of lesson.
Oh, like a Tales from the Crypts.
But what's the lesson here?
I don't know. Don't overstay your welcome.
Arguably, there might be a populist morality because the Allisons are a bit of like kind of snobby people.
Yeah, but not, like, as bad as I would have thought. Which I do wonder if that's only because this was written in 1950, and what only seems like microaggressions now are those, like, oh, a big slam on country folks in the 50s.
Yeah, I mean, certainly nothing they do or nothing about their personality would warrant killing them.
Yeah. But
take it away, Derek.
Okay. So we have the Allisons, Robert, who is 60, and Janet, who's 58, and they have a little country cottage someplace in New England. I'm going to assume Maine, because...
They're the most backwards.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I love how you always hear the writing advice, like, show, don't tell.
Mm-hmm.
Then in this classic story, she's like, oh, the Allisons were ordinary people. Let me just tell you about, you know, it's like, that show, don't tell, that's fucking bullshit.
Who came up with that?
I don't know. It's just that's one of those stupid... I think it's like high school teachers repeat it. Yeah, they don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if when the story works, it works.
Yeah, but I mean, does it always work when that happens? No.
I mean, nothing always works in any way, but
I mean, I would guess...
I think in a short story, you're setting up the premise.
Mm-hmm. You gotta be quick, compact.
You gotta tell, and then you can show... like. She shows the ambiguity about what may or may not happen at the end. Yep. But in the setup, you don't have time to, like, well, I think the Allisons are X, Y. It's like, no, this is what these people are like.
You don't have 30 pages just talking about the Allisons.
That would be my version game. That gets in there.
It would be your version, for sure. So they have this country cottage. We're going to say in Maine. We don't know for sure. Somewhere in New England. 7 miles from the nearest town. No running water. No electricity. But, you know, for 17 years, they've loved it. I mean, spent time in a little lake house. Not my lake house, as you always are confused with. Not my family's lake house, which you are also always confused with. Just a lake house in general. So usually they leave on the Tuesday after Labor Day. But this year they decide, hey, you know, we're getting old. The city's kind of so-so. Let's stay here another month and see how that goes. They go into town and tell Mr. Babcock, who's the grocer, And he's like, oh, I've never heard of anyone steaming the lake after Labor Day. I'm not going to do a Maine accent, but we all know what it's going to sound like. Fred Gwynn in Pet Sematary. You got it. So, the Allisons think that he's a colorful country bumpkin, and, you know, it's this generations of inbreeding in the bad land that is, you know, Maine, or wherever this takes place, because they're city people.
There are a couple lines in that exchange that I like, how she says, like, Mrs. Allison always spoke of the city to Mr. Babcock as though it were Mr. Babcock's dream to go there. Which, I mean, I'm guilty of all the time myself.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a man who thinks anything smaller than New York is not a city.
I mean, the first time I went to Boston, I was like, where's the rest of it?
Yeah, Boston's only a fourth the size of Columbus. What do you expect?
Okay, the first time
Columbus is no city, my friend.
The first time I went to Columbus, I thought, is this it?
Have you actually been to Columbus?
No, but okay. I don't need to.
You get the idea how it works. Yeah.
Is that true?
It is true.
I thought Columbus was true as of a couple of years ago. 500,000 or 600,000 people. Columbus isn't 2 million people.
I think the city itself is just larger. What they consider the city of Columbus is larger, so it's not like perhaps by square footage, but whatever. I mean, Boston's also like, we built this on the same layout of people who had horses, so you kind of crammed in there, unlike a city that was built for cars.
Yeah, but I like those horse cities.
Well. Come to Boston. I like see seeing our beans.
I like seeing that shit pile up.
So they spend the day out and about because, they're 7 miles from town, so they don't want to get out too often, which, 7 miles doesn't seem like a whole lot, but I guess in the 50s when driving was still a somewhat new concept, I suppose, going 7 miles was a big deal. They have some more, everyone in the town seems to have heard through the town grapevine that, you're staying past Labor Day. No one's ever done that before, which is also a kind of weird thing for the ending. Like, are they being attacked by the town? The town does not seem as though, no one's ever done this before. Therefore, we must destroy you. It's like, no one's that's never happened before. We don't know what's going to happen at this point.
Or maybe they're more like. You can edit out the slow part. But no, I think maybe they're more like, there's a reason why people don't do that.
Uh-huh. So there's a larger...
It's a little bit like the lottery. What is like, this is the rule that exists. And we can't exactly explain it. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be... Like, I don't think each and every one of these townspeople are involved in this conspiracy.
Yeah, this seems like more almost a cosmic event that occurs for people who stay later. Not like I don't think Mr. Babcock's sneaking up with a knife at the end of this, but they also try and pull in that they notice there's a light in their neighbor's house the night before. Whatever happens, so there doesn't seem to be a human element to it. But everyone in town who you think would be the human element seems just more like confused that them staying longer than like
I
angrily
read it
at this.
It is the people doing this. I kind of read it.
I think it is, but I don't know if that pays off ultimately.
I think
based
one
off of the rules they set up.
I think one of them says something like, you'll find out what happens or something like, it's like, I guess you won't know until you do it or something.
That's the Allisons are saying that. Everyone's like, no one stayed this late. And like, it's gotta be a first for somebody. Something along those lines that the Allisons say, not the town people say. So I don't know. But, they go around town and they're trying to get all their errands done at the same time. Everyone in town seems to be confused with this.
If you don't mind, there's one. They're buying baking dishes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And there's this one line I like. I don't know if you wrote it down or.
I did not, so go for it.
So she's just talking about buying these glass baking dishes. And she writes, since the country people, with their instinctive distrust of anything that did not look as permanent as trees and rocks and sky, had only recently begun to experiment in aluminum baking dishes instead of ironware, and had, apparently from the memory of local inhabitants, discarded stoneware in favor of iron. Which is kind of a snob. She'll say
yeah, but
like,
I mean, that's not like a... I mean, I guess that seems just more quaint due to the 71 years in between the story and reading it now. That like, he's a sick burn on it. But, maybe that's...
Yeah, but then she also mentions, like, when she's getting the glass, the aluminum, or the baking dishes, she's like, mm-hmm. She mentions, I could have gotten these in New York, but blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, they want the personal interaction.
Well, you know what the city's like in the fall. Mm-hmm. You know, she can't really remember. She sees a familiar face, but she's like, oh, did that person work at the grocery store? Like, I mean, these are, I mean, God, you know how many fucking people we see each day when you don't remember the fuck these people are, you know? Like, so I don't think it's certainly not like a sin, but I guess I kind of wondered if the townspeople like hated these people and they're just like waiting for the moment they fuck up so they can kill her.
I mean, we certainly get from every Stephen King story that takes place in a small town about the small town people hate the Flatlanders that come up there as a, you know, out of towners. But I mean, this does not seem as antagonistic behind it. So they head back to their little cottage. They have the kerosene man comes because this is the 50 and they need their kerosene. And they're like, hey, we're staying another month. You can give us some extra kerosene. And he has some perfectly reasonable explanation like, oh, we don't really budget that for people staying longer than this because people don't do it. So we can't give you anything else. They're like, oh, how about some ice? Because again, the 50s is like, oh, yeah, same thing with ice. So, I mean, every explanation that we get for why the locals can't help out or extend a helping hand towards the city folk, it's all reasonably explained, which is kind of adds to the ambiguity that I like.
Yeah,
like,
and he also, he does say like, oh, maybe I can get you some ice. Mm-hmm. You can't get that damn kerosene, come on.
Yeah, it's a hot commodity. Please, kerosene? Yeah, they call Babcock, too, on the phone to get a couple extra groceries that they don't have in their usual delivery. He's like, oh, yeah, I don't really deliver after Labor Day because, you know, the guy I have deliver goes back to school and it's not really worth it for me to drive with it personally. Sorry, I didn't tell you this yesterday. I just kind of spaced my mind. I mean, like, no one stays. I mean, it seems more like, oh, hey, no one does this. So everything that can be explained by we don't budget for this or we don't plan for this.
And this also mentioned that there's the Halls who live 3 miles away who mm-hmm. bring them butter and eggs and like they're upstate, supposedly.
Yeah.
Although, do people outside New York say upstate? Suspicious.
I mean, I guess we don't know how upstate they're going.
No.
So, I mean, I guess, I don't know if this might not be Maine then, because there's no, where are you going upstate? Nowhere.
Yeah,
because there's no towns other than the downtown.
So it has to be some podunk New York town.
Yeah, or, you know, it could be, I mean, they don't consider New York New England. You guys are your own thing. Maybe like
although, north of Albany, it might as well be New England.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I guess what sports team do you root for? That's how you discover this thing. That's why Connecticut, not real part of New England. They're their own garbage thing. Go eat your nutmeg, Connecticut. You can quote me on that. So the next day, Mr. Allison tries to drive into town, but it turns out the car won't start, and they can't get the repair place on the phone either. So he goes down to check their mail, which is a mile away, and he comes back with a letter from their son. And the letter seems kind of off, but neither Mr. or Mrs. Allison kind of place what's wrong with it.
Yeah.
It just seems kind of unusual. And it's so unusual, they're like, oh, it seems off, we can't, nothing, if you look over each individual sentence, nothing's off, but just overall it kind of seems off, and the letter has a unusual number of dirty fingerprints on it, which is also disturbing them, but they can't quite place why.
Although they did mention that it was postmarked Chicago, where their son is from, mm-hmm. and that it looks like his handwriting.
Yeah.
And then I did think the son's letter was like, if I was reading the substance, it's mentioned like, oh, it's so great that you're staying at the lake longer, since you have less demands on your time, fewer friends, etc. And I'd be like, what a dick, dude. Gotta mention I got fewer friends because I'm fucking old. Come on, man.
That's not the son you want to raise.
I mean, maybe they're right that their son isn't ingrate.
Quite
but
possible.
I mean, what is the alter? Like, what did the townspeople write a fake letter?
Yeah, so I mean, like, this is the weird thing about the letter is it seems to them that it's off. Although it's in their son's handwriting, they can't place anything wrong with it. The only thing that really seems to be off is the dirty fingerprints.
And it's also, like, very late, it's mentioned.
Yeah. But they also mentioned, like, oh, the mail gets late sometimes. Just like now. Thanks, DeJoy.
Who the fuck is DeJoy? Isn't the mail always late? Isn't that part of its thing?
I mean, the mail used to be not as late.
It's like, hey, get FedEx if you want it on time. Isn't that their motto? It's like, hey, we're not
20 times more? No one wants to pay that for a letter.
No one wants a
letter. It's almost like the U.S. government is subsidizing the mail.
No one wants a letter.
Everyone wants a letter.
Email,
wouldn't you love a letter from somebody in the mail?
Yeah, I don't know, Derek. Maybe one day I'll get one from you.
Maybe. Now I'm gonna send you one out of spite.
I like it. I'm looking forward to it. I want to see that. I want to know you spent 95 cents on a fucking stamp.
I think it's 53 now, and I got those forever stamps. I'm looking at some right now. They're Christmas.
I want a letter that's big enough for two stamps. Is what I'm obviously saying.
Oh, that's a pretty heavy letter.
Get working.
Okay. So they try the phone again, but now the phone is dead, and there's a storm that's been brewing over the past couple of days. Slowly seems to be actually, you know, building up to something and rolling at this point. They listen to the radio, but as I'm sitting there outside, it seems like the radio seems totally out of place and alien, and almost as though it's invading the forest around them in the little woods. Mrs. Allison wonders if they're supposed to do anything.
Yeah, I like that line a lot.
Yeah. I mean, so, like, they are both aware at this point that something is going on, and they don't know what it is, and I'm sure if you ask them, they couldn't put it into words, but it seems just like, there is an impending something occurring that they don't know what they need to do for it, but it seems like not a whole lot. So they wait around. Mr. Allison mentions, hey, I think the car has been tampered with. And she thinks that, oh, phone lines are probably cut too. And it's weird, there was a light on their neighbor's house, so despite them being away, right? And then they just kind of sit there and wait. And that's how the story ends. Nice and ambiguous.
She says she feels better about the letter, which is like, what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean,
feels
like,
better,
I
like that the letter is legitimate, or that she's better about what's going to happen. Also, yeah. I mean, how handy is Mr. Allison that he knows that the car had been tampered with? He could just be like, he wasn't checking the wires or whatever the fuck.
Maybe he was. I don't know. Cars in the 50s. I'm sure there's a lot less stuff in there to have issues.
I will read the last paragraph, if you don't mind.
Ooh, go right
the
ahead.
Wind coming up suddenly over the lake swept around the summer cottage and slapped hard at the windows. Mr. and Mrs. Allison involuntarily moved closer together, and with the first sudden crash of thunder, Mr. Allison reached out and took his wife's hand. And then, while the lightning flashed outside and the radio faded and sputtered, the two old people huddled together in their summer cottage and waited. I mean, it's kind of sweet that they hold hands, you know, during the story you kind of like aren't their biggest fan, and then you're kind of like, wait a second, they're not really bad people at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which do you think they would like the least, dying mysteriously or being called two old people?
I mean, there's some of these is like, oh, ancient people, but I mean, 58 and 60, those are perfectly young ages still in this time, so I guess you've improved some of them.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's another thing you think about it. I guess they're retired, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have to assume that. I guess so.
They have to be, I guess,
off.
Well off, right?
Yeah, I mean, we don't learn anything about them, really, other than they can afford to have a second home. Although, I don't know how weird that was back in the 50s.
Yeah.
For a main cottage. But, no, this has a level of ambiguity that I highly enjoy, and perhaps I'm a little nostalgia that perhaps when I get to an age where there's an impending doom, I can just kind of sit down and, you know, accept it and wait for it.
Haven't you felt that feeling your whole life, Derek?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's not like, oh, I want to sit around and wait for it. I gotta live my life in the meantime for my current impending doom.
Well,
I want to have like a finite
impending
doom
is coming too. You don't know what's right around the corner.
Yeah, I think that's the issue here.
Although I wonder do you think the appendix to the story would be like a couple days follow, they realize nothing happens, and they have the greatest sex of their life, of their old ass lives, being like, we got a fucking new lease on life here.
I mean, Viagra wasn't invented yet, so probably not.
I mean, if you're thinking about it logical, in the sense of, like, imagine this story takes place in something like the real world.
Mm-hmm.
The odds of a kind of town-wide conspiracy designed to kill people who stay after Labor Day for arbitrary reasons sounds like something that would not make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it does a good job of making you feel like it's, like, inevitably coming. And there's a reason for it.
Yeah, like there's definitely a building sense of doom that works throughout the entire story. And it's kind of referenced in the storm that's slowly brewing over the couple days. Is like, oh, here's this big thing that's going to break at some point towards the end. But it does a very good job of, you know, building you up towards the end.
Yeah, it does give you a good feeling of tension.
Yeah.
Just like when things start going wrong, you're like in a bad situation and things are just getting worse.
Mm-hmm. But ultimately, like, there's not I think in one of the notes or something I read online, it's like, oh, she wanted to write a story where you can't pinpoint the exact point where things go wrong. Like, oh, this is the moment things go from bad to worse. It's just kind of like slow build the whole time without enough like pieces to say, oh, this is the thing here.
The counterpoint, yeah. When the car stops working.
Well, I mean,
that's when you're fucked.
We don't find out till the end that was a sabotage.
Yeah. And not in the shitty Beastie Boys way, but in the shitty way.
I mean, I would say that is the best Beastie Boys song.
I mean, Beastie Boys, get out of here.
Yeah, in general, yes. But if you're going to embarrass us, that's choice.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the story is great. I highly recommend this story over mine. But I like both of our stories. But this is, I think, like a classic. Like, Call of like one of the greatest short stories I've ever read in my life.
And not one, like, I had not heard of this until I read The Weird a couple of years back. And, I mean, everyone knows The Lottery, and I feel like more people should know this than...
Well, maybe I not.
No, more people should know this than The Lottery, because I think The Lottery is, like, a good analogy that you learned in high school.
Yeah, I think these two stories kind of, like, reduce one another a little bit, because they both play into the same premise a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, arbitrary rules that are followed, and people don't even know why this is happening, but it's just the way it is. I think The Lottery became so popular just because it ran in the New Yorker and it was like, what the fuck is this? Like, people were like shocked by it. They were like,
no.
Dear God.
No.
Whereas maybe. This ran in like a lesser known magazine and did not have as much of the impact. But it is a great story. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I recommend. I mean, we got some bang. Well, we got one banger. But I like reading short stories, and we will continue next week with two more selections.
From part two, the Medusa and the Shield.
Psychological horror.
Yeah. Or maybe we'll mix it up. Who can say?
Who can say? Well, come next time. That means if Derek doesn't get to reading it by then.
Oh.
Find out.
Adios.